This edition of the Monocle Weekly was first broadcast on the 14th of July 2013 here on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to episode 210 of the Monocle Weekly, and that's with me, Andrew Tuck, and Steve Bloomfield.
On the show today, we'll be talking about Mexico, its art, its culture, and how it's seen across the globe, and even where to see more of it. The organisers of London's MexFest will be joining us later.
We'll be focusing on the changing face of London's Covent Garden too, via the historical eye of photographer Clive Borsnell, who's been documenting the area since the 1960s.
And we'll be turning the airwaves blue when we talk to author Melissa Moore about the history of swearing and bad language.
And I'm an expert on that. That's all coming up. Plus, Tom Edwards will be here with the news of the week. And also, we'll be looking at some tunes too, while playing them maybe, right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. Hello, Steve.
Hello, Andrew.
Well, we've got swearing and we haven't got Robert Bound.
That's very true. He's off in Bordeaux, I believe.
Oh, in Bordeaux.
Packed his trunks. Packed his trunks in his trunk.
I hope the owners of the vineyards have locked them up. That's all I can say. I think he will be enjoying himself very much. He did come to work one day this week wearing swimming trunks. Not like the shortest swimming trunks, but they were shorts, but they were definitely swimming trunks.
And also a T-shirt, which he... Can we tell a story?
I think we can tell the story. He'd borrowed it off somebody we know who even they, I don't think, knew what the T-shirt was. And it said something like, teens do it better.
Yes.
Which is already a kind of, not a great T-shirt to be wearing
but
in office.
But he assumed it was like, you know...
Jokey.
Like a band name or something to do with that. And then, yes.
And it turns out it's the title of a gay magazine and Robert Bound is not gay.
For teenage boys.
Yes. So he'd come in wearing green shorts and a very gay T-shirt and was wandering around central London all day, wondering why none of the ladies were looking at him for once.
Do you want to know, there's an interesting coda to that story in that the magazine is called EY. And this week, Ernst & Young, the London-based accountancy firm, decided to rebrand themselves EY. They didn't do a Google search for EY beforehand. And now whenever you hit EY, then as well as Ernst & Young comes up this magazine with the slogan, teens do it better.
Well, maybe there's some crossover. Maybe some Ernst & Young people are actually in EY as well. We'll find out in another show. Not today, though.
No, indeed. Nice show, though, we've got to look ahead to today.
Yes, we have a whole section on swearing, which is going to be one of those things which we will have to be very careful about.
We were talking about this earlier, and I had what I thought was a very good historical swearing fact, which you actually pointed out was perhaps incorrect.
Only because I've read the book.
Yes, that's true. So, but we'll come to that later.
There's lots of bleeps coming up. Next, we're going to be looking at the news ahead with Mr. Tom Edwards.
Keeping you in the loop and on the ball, this is Tom Edwards with his weekly look ahead.
Welcome, Tom.
Hi, Andrew. Hello, Steve.
You sound excited.
Oh, I'm always excited. I love being here. It's one of the highlights of my week.
It's the highlight of my week too.
I said it's one of them. I wouldn't say the highlight.
Oh,
but
really?
I'm touched that you feel that way.
Now, Now, later on in the show, we're going to be interviewing an author who's written a work of art about called Holy Shit, which is about swearing.
Yeah.
Do you have a favourite swear word, Tom?
That was a bit much.
That was well timed, wasn't it?
That was well timed.
I left a dramatic pause.
Yes,
but whoever was doing that was right on the button. No, I'm generally kind of a fan of obscene language, and I think it's a shame that we can't be more cavalier with it.
I think you're relatively cavalier in the office,
Steve. I'm very well spoken, as you know.
I don't know. You occasionally, you know, your face gets all red, sort of the brow furrows, and you just suddenly unleash a.
Now. The news this week, Tom.
What is the news? Yeah, I'll do it without any obscenity. Well, there might be some people swearing in India, of course, because today...
Spurious link, if ever I've heard one.
This is good, because this is... The people will be upset because India's discontinuing its telegram service.
No.
It was ticking towards 150 years. I thought they'd get to that symbolic date, of course. Samuel Morse sent the first telegram. The US, people like that, long since stopped their telegram service. Not so in India. Quite a lot of messages still sent, maybe as many as 5,000 per day.
Really? People still, well, they call them telegrams, don't they, at weddings. But people don't ever sort of say, now, let's read out some emails from people that can't be here.
But
they just say, let's read some telegrams.
Can you still get the wedding ones even?
No, no, you can't. What I'm saying is, when the best man does that thing, okay, he says, oh, let's read, he doesn't say, here are some emails from your mates that can be asked. He says, so should we have bleeped out arse there? he says, you know, here are some telegrams, despite the fact that they're not.
But I think it's sad. I mean, we're obviously fans of print and traditional forms of communication. Now, that's not to say I'm not a Luddite, but there's something charming about the telegram. I think it's a shame that it's going. And we'll be judging and finding out exactly what people in India have made of it when we hear from our Arti Bettigeri, who's been dispatched, as it were, to the telegram office to get some sights and sounds.
And that's for a report this week?
That will be with us tomorrow, right here on Monocle 24, Andrew.
How is she sending that report?
Well, sadly, Arti had wanted to send us a farewell telegram.
Oh, had she?
But you can't send them from beyond India. So the limitations of the medium are also exposed at the same time, unfortunately. It's okay, an internal thing only.
That's a shame.
So we don't get to read one.
Well, we've missed out on that. I never received a telegram in my life.
Not even on your 100th birthday from the Queen.
No queen sent me any message. But anyway, okay, second story.
Okay, let's continue on to, well, on Thursday, this is quite interesting. There's going to be a big rally in Moscow. Alexei Navalny, who's obviously the noted sort of anti-Kremlin leader and campaigner, he's trying to get the mayoral job there as well. A lot of young people sort of rate Navalny very highly. He's very popular. He has a good profile. Understandably, he's not that popular with people like Vladimir Putin, for example.
And
at the same time, he's trying to sort of orchestrate to get onto the ballot for this mayoral job. He's also battling these embezzlement charges that he's been saddled with. Obviously, a fair amount of speculation that
they're nonsense.
The charges are perhaps wouldn't stand up to scrutiny. And in order to get on, registered to run in the mayoral race, he needs to collect a whole number of signatures from all these kind of municipal deputies. And there's all of this kind of machinations in Russia, and particularly in Moscow politics. It's quite lurid and murky. But there's this big sort of rally that he'll be at. And it's always interesting, I think, to sort of gauge the response of the political community and the community more broadly when Navalny appears at these kind of events.
And probably the last time he gets to go to one of these events before inevitably going to jail on probably trumped up charges.
Yeah, I mean, you never know. It occasionally
there's a 99% success rate, if success is the right word, when it comes to prosecutions in.
So there's 1%, Steve.
In Moscow. I'm just
saying. Hang on to that.
I'm just saying.
That's the world of Russia, and we've been to India. Where's our third port?
How do you feel about a trip to Japan?
I'm coming.
Great stuff. Sorry, that was so upbeat, then, wasn't it? On Saturday. It's the upper house elections in Japan. Now, this is quite interesting because obviously Shinzo Abe, we've got Abenomics. There's a lot of good work, well done, seeming to kind of revitalize Japan's, well, it's been a flagging economy for some time. Abe's doing quite a good job. But one of the problems that they have in Japan is this kind of split system. And obviously the upper house was lost to the LDP, Abe's party. And, well, in some respects, it's kind of going full circle because a lot of people suggested that was his fault. When he was last prime minister, they lost control of the majority. This was back in 2007. And people suggested that it did sort of a lasting, enduring damage to their LDP. They're in quite a good position to potentially retake control of that house, control both houses. And that would obviously be not only a vindication of Abe's work recently, but of him politically, kind of his second coming. And I think that would be quite interesting to watch in Japan, which, I mean, we talk about this quite often with our bureau chief, Fiona Wilson, and other observers of the scene there. There can often be a lot of, I guess you could call it, diffidence about the domestic politics in Japan, particularly from younger people. But I think the way Abe has approached the economic challenges and this particular battle, the fact that there's a bit of personality involved in it, will be quite interesting to see how they fare. So that's all happening next weekend.
And did you hear he's building his own stately home? It's going to be called Downton Abe.
You know what the worst thing was? Do you know, that was throughout the entire bit where you were talking seriously about Shinzo Abe. Andrew was just, sort of doodling in a corner and he had his thinking face on. I was like, oh, this could be a really insightful about Japanese economics.
Within that swearing theme, that pun was so offensive, that should have been bleeped out.
I quite like that. Well, I was just thinking Abenomics. It's a kind of a funny kind of... It stuck, that phrase.
It has,
yeah. Well, that's the thing. You get a catchy little word like that.
I like Downton Abbey. I think I'm going to suggest that to Japanese TV.
It sounds like a theme park to me. There's money in this.
I will build the theme park.
19th
as well.
Century England matched with 21st century Japanese politics.
Winner. What about, do you want another little one? Change of pace?
Yes, change of pace.
Another continent, shall we? We've done quite well so far. Let's go over to the United States. Let's go to San Diego.
Okay, I'm packed.
Great, this is good. It's a worldwide tour. It's the Comic Con this week. And I think Steve Bloomfield might have been a comic aficionado.
This is less geeky now than it used to be, isn't it?
Well, this is it. So it's one of the world's largest and most important comic conventions, as in comic books, not comics as in comedy. It was established in 1970, and as Steve suggests, it has had its run-ins with geekdom down the years. But now, well over 100,000 people come every year, not just kind of professional comic writers and illustrators, other exhibitors, guests from all different walks of life. And a lot of the crossover, which we've seen increasingly between comic book, fantasy fiction, all that kind of thing, and of course movies and mainstream television. So it's a real talking shop now. So
and it's
lots
where
of big
lots
deals
of them,
have been done.
Yeah, and it's where also lots of them sort of launch their new sort of sci-fi films and things, isn't
Absolutely.
It? Anything and interesting being launched?
Well, I was kind of more drawn by some of the other hangers-on
okay.
who now associate themselves with the Comic-Con. And I know one of Andrew's favourite bands, Metallica, they're going to be in San Diego for the first time. They're doing a Q&A and they've got a 3D movie out. So all of these kind of tie-ins with Hollywood and the music industry as well. And Metallica, Andrew, will be actually out and about at a surprise venue in San Diego playing a show on Thursday night.
So if you
venue to be decided. So if you were there, you could check them out. Two birds with one stone.
I can back comb my hair, get ready for it, get a black T-shirt. That could look good.
That would be the news highlight to end the news highlights. Let's make that happen. But that's just something else. That's what's happening in all different continents of the world this week.
Well, that's all right then, isn't it? You know, well, you've given us four continents.
You came in all glum. Now you look all pleased with yourself.
That, do you know what that is, Andrew? That's the power of tomorrow's news today.
Well, thank you very much indeed. And what's your week ahead?
Well, my personal week ahead.
Yes.
There'll be no swearing.
Okay.
Oh, it didn't last very long, did it?
Well, you behave well, and we shall see you next week. The rise of Latin American countries in recent years from being economic underdogs to entrepreneurial high flyers is a success story in a world economy currently a little short of those.
But a nation we may have heard slightly less about in recent years than booming Brazil or all-conquering Colombia is Mexico. However, a festival in London this weekend is looking to change perceptions of the country. MexFest showcases the best of Mexican culture, such as film, design, music, businesses, and of course food, across events throughout London. Joining us now are its organisers, Hugo Van Bell and Manuel Diaz Cerebrian. Welcome to you both. Hugo, perhaps if we can start with you. Why is it that you feel that Mexico doesn't have the global reputation for full culture that perhaps Brazil does at the moment?
Well, I think that's also perhaps a misconception in itself. I think there is a boom which is taking place right now, certainly in Europe, and we're seeing it in London just these weeks that we've been here. The film industry, architecture, so many of Mexico's cultural exports are now taking form, and there's so many countries and companies around the world who are looking to collaborate with Mexico again.
I guess the only thing is that for some European people, we have this, you know, amazing perception of, you know, the likes of Frida Kahlo. But for some people, they haven't quite updated the image of what's going on. So I agree with you when you just look through the catalogue of stuff that you have going on here in London. Extraordinary filmmaking. I was in Mexico City recently, and the art gallery scene there is extraordinary. And as you say, the architecture world is great. But somehow those greats, I think it happens to any country when you have this kind of extraordinary period of, you know, Diego Rivera, suddenly those people can dominate a little bit. I know there's a great show going on here in London around that as well. How important do you think is it to mix that history and that, you know, extraordinary cultural heritage in with more contemporary things?
I think it's essential. We have that great cultural legacy, that heritage which you talk about, and it's so important to use that as a platform for all the new creative industries which are up and coming, new names in all of the creative industries who become cultural ambassadors for their country. And those are the people that have been here in London this week at MexFest showing their work and looking to work more in the UK.
Manuel, it's one of those things when we do our annual soft power survey, Mexico actually does pretty well on a lot of the barometers. And you know, Andrew mentioned art galleries. You've got some of the best art galleries in the world. But it's about spreading that message outside of Mexico. Do events like this MexFest here in London and, you know, other events around the world helped to change those perceptions and spread that message?
Definitely. This is the, especially this one has been, is the first one that's taking over the whole city. As we mentioned earlier, the idea to get this joint venture with the BNA, with the Royal Academy, Rich Mix, and also BFI and Canary Wharf, in a way, shows and showcase Mexico in a different way. Definitely, this helps tremendously to change the perception and also, ideally, to increase business and visitors to Mexico.
And Hugo, for you, the spread of Mexican influence, obviously, the huge number of Mexicans living in America, that Mexicans are kind of spreading around the world. There's a newfound wealth, as we were mentioning at the top of the show, in Mexico, which means that there are some very wealthy patrons of the arts and massive collectors. Do you feel this is a really important moment, actually, for the spread of kind of Mexicanness through the kind of cultural world?
Yeah, and I think it's very much to do with the collaboration and cooperation that can come about through events like this, in this case between the UK and Mexico, but in Mexico itself, between private sector, government institutions, NGOs. There's all sorts of organizations that have come together to work on MexFest, and we're looking to recreate MexFest in other cities around the world, potentially in the cities of the countries that most invest in Mexico. That's the next step.
And Manuel, how important is it for filmmakers, for artists in Mexico now to get a global audience? Or are actually increasingly many of them feeling, I'm actually quite happy being well known here in Mexico, I can make a good career here? How important is it to go overseas now?
Well, first of all, globalization is very important. And I think nowadays, you're going to be actually, due to the advances, the technology and all this stuff, there is not just such a thing to remain actually well known only in the place where you live. Nowadays, it's impossible to avoid that. And I guess we are all motivated to grow and actually to be known and renowned and recognized internationally. Obviously, for Mexicans, is the case.
And for both of you, what have been a couple of the highlights that have happened here in London? Things that you think really kind of begin to tell a really interesting story about the country?
Interesting things that happened here, actually. But yeah. First of all, as you mentioned before, actually, we've been actually, the last 10 years, we've been showcasing Mexico very intense with the Aztecs and Frida Kahlo and all this stuff. But this is, in a way, what we needed to do is to come out of Mexico with the contemporary stuff. There is such a new energy happening now. New generations are waking up with the influence of the old roots to create new things. I think, in a way, yes, we are well known worldwide with certain things that are just the typical things, which are fantastic. Mexico has such a great story. But I think the new stuff, the new culture, and the new tendencies had to be communicated. This is very important.
And I would add to that the recent success of filmmakers, cinematographers, architects who are sought out all over the world to work from Mexico. And I think that's particularly important that we're able to showcase their work to bring to an international audience.
And the strength of something like the film world or the art world, that doesn't happen by accident in most countries. Is that because within Mexico there is a good heritage of film schools and art schools? Is it because you have a good education system in the beginning that helps bring these people up, do you think?
In the cinema, Hugo will answer this better than me. On the other hand, to tell you, we just participate very actively on this exhibition Pinta, and actually we explore where Latin American and Mexican design is standing. And to our surprise, it's very well recognized, but is recognized but not well known. So we had to explore and create these sort of platforms to bring along all these new artists and new expressions of art.
And I'd say in the film world, certainly the schools have played a big part in that. But I would also say that the recent defunding schemes and tax incentives that have been made available to different film companies, both national and international companies, great opportunity for co-productions in Mexico. And that's also been provided a launchpad for Mexican directors and producers to go international.
Do you get a sense that there is enough support in Mexico from government for these sorts of things, be it filmmakers or chefs or theatre or art, to actually get the support they need? I mean, we interviewed Mexico's new president a few months ago, and he was talking about the importance of soft power and how important it was for Mexico's brand around the world, that all these things that you've been talking about are really seen and are encouraged. It's one thing for him to say that. Do you think that there is actually enough government backing for this sort of thing? And does it actually need it?
Well, we're going through that transition right now. The government's been in power for 6 months, new government. So we're seeing that firsthand. I mean, our event is an example of government support right across the board. The cultural ministry, Brand Mexico, Marca País, which you know, has considerable budget to be supporting these sort of initiatives, as well as creative industries abroad, education ministry. We'll see in the next few months whether this is entirely true, but I believe from what we've seen with this festival, with the support that we've received, I believe that we've got exciting times coming ahead in the next few years.
Now, I think Steve wants to ask you a very different question, which is about a sport.
Yeah, look, right, Hugo. I was flicking through this program here for MexFest, and I saw there was something that was missing, which not many people know about Mexico, but that apparently there's a sport, a quintessentially English sport, that actually Mexico's not that bad at, and you in particular are one of the proponents of this sport. Is that right? Where's the cricket, is what I'm asking.
The cricket. Yeah, the cricket's been in Mexico since 1823. British railroad workers arrived with the cricket 25 years before football. And I've been playing cricket in Mexico for 20 years now. Absolutely love it. We play, there's four teams in Mexico. We play amongst other teams in Latin America, a few teams in the States as well. A lot of fun.
So you've played internationally for Mexico?
Yes, I play for the national team currently.
Bowl?
Bit of an all-rounder, I like to think.
And there's an adjunct to that. Do you think that Mexico is actually pretty good at taking in cultural influences from elsewhere? Because often when we think of Latin American countries and the strength of their arts, it's amazing, but it is a bit sealed off. But do you think actually that's a good example that Mexicans are kind of good at kind of opening the door to influences from elsewhere?
I think so. I mean, certainly in the case with cricket, we've received funding from the ICC to teach cricket in Mexican schools. and they're open to that. So it starts out through the British international schools. And then from then on, we've got more and more Mexicans starting to play cricket.
Just finally, it's Sunday lunchtime. It's obviously a nice warm day. Lots of people will be going outside today. If you want to catch a little bit of MexFest today, what are the big highlights? But they can be indoors as well, despite the weather. What are the things you particularly recommend for a Sunday afternoon?
Well, it's our closing night. Certainly, if they can get down to Rich Mix, I'd encourage that for this evening, 8 o'clock. The three voices from Ortelia Portillo. That's our closing documentary. And that'll be followed by the closing party there at the Rich Mix, which are going to offer some great music, a lot of dancing. So if you can come on down, that'll be the place to be tonight, Rich Mix.
And Manuel, are you going to be on the bar?
As usual.
On the bar, as in working behind the bar or standing on the bar?
Dancing on the bar, working at the bar.
I wish I had my time.
Well, guys, thank you very much for coming here.
Thanks for having us.
That's Manuel Diaz Cebrián and also Hugo Van Bella, who are the organisers of MexFest.
Aspiring for greener cities and easier commutes, more and more people are switching to bikes. From Zurich to Toronto and on to Buenos Aires, we film pedal makers who've opened up artisanal bike shops to provide bespoke services for two-wheeled enthusiasts.
Frames are recycled and reworked, featuring Monochrome's minimalist design aesthetic. This bespoke upcycling has turned them into one of the Argentinian capital's greenest takes on transport.
Bike shops with a difference. In the film's menu on monocle.com.
We're going to have some music now, and staying in Mexico, this is from Guadalajara's finest purveyors of indie pop, Technicolor Fabrics with Flowing Sky.
I'm
That was Flowing Sky by Technicolor Fabrics. You're listening to The Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. Welcome back to The Monocle Weekly with me, Andrew Tuck, and Steve Bloomfield. London's Covent Garden is a neighbourhood that's home to shopping, theatres, and no shortage of real-life drama on a daily basis. And it's changed its face almost as often as the street performers who gather there to cut their teeth.
Photographer Clive Borsnell has been documenting the evolution of the area since the 1960s, from its years as a thriving fruit and veg market to the tourist trappings of today. His book, The Covent Garden Collection, tells a visual history of the neighbourhood, and Monocle's David Michon met him earlier to find out more about the story of a London landmark.
I've known Covent Garden since the 1950s, and I worked in as an assistant to a fashion photographer in Covent Garden in Great Queen Street in the early 60s. And I knew Covent Garden well. And yet one morning in 1968, I found myself at the top of James Street by Longacre. One beautiful summer morning, 5 o'clock in the morning. I have no idea or memory why I was there at 5 o'clock in the morning. But I looked down James Street and the light, the bustle, the way the people were moving back and forth, the trucks, the barrows, the language was just, I thought, my God. And it was one of these moments when you know something, you've known it for years, but taken it totally for granted. And in that single moment, I didn't take it for granted. I looked at it for the first time and I thought, wow, I got to put this on film. The only camera I owned that I could use was a 6x6 Hasselblad, which is a medium format camera. Medium format reportage is quite a tough cookie because, you know, you've got to be really... my kit weighed about 60 pounds. However, I started to photograph and my first pictures were, well, they were crap. I also realised that I just simply didn't know the market. I didn't know the people. I didn't know how it worked, and that's why the pictures were crap. So I had to get to know it.
And do you think that was quite a common thing amongst Londoners to kind of take Covent Garden for granted, or?
Oh, absolutely. And of course, one of the things that the market people, they didn't dislike, but they gave everybody a pretty rough time, especially photographers, of what they used to call fair weather photographers. They used to come down in the sunshine when it was pissing with rain or snow, or 5 o'clock in a very cold morning. You never saw any of them. But I was different. And it was about 9 months to a year's time that I really began to understand, one, how the market moved and worked. They understood and were beginning to accept me because no apologies were needed or given. If I was in the way, I got walloped. If I wasn't in the way, fine, no problem. And I think that the market people had for years, they'd have people coming down, snapping them away. But this one, suddenly this guy was different. And the reason I had to do it this way was by getting to know the market, by repeating a lot of the pictures that I'd done the day before or the week before or the month before. I was refining those pictures. And the market people actually understood that process. They understood the photographic process of getting to know and love and respect a market.
And when your photos presumably started getting good after a bit of refinement and you started showing people, what was their reaction? I mean, I imagine that some people were quite surprised that these images had come from Covent Garden, a place that they probably frequented, but maybe didn't see what you saw.
I have to be honest with you. I only showed 3 or 4 very close friends the work I was doing in the market for quite a number of years. And as you may remember, the market actually closed and moved to Nine Elms in 1974. And then the process of editing this work, which was enormous amounts of work, I mean, you know, thousands of negatives had to be gone through, and transparencies. And so I spent a couple of years editing pictures, gradually finding them down to a collection. And then I started going around the publishers, and of course no publisher wanted to know. And then the Sunday Times, with Hasselblad, as it happened, ran a competition, a national photographic competition entitled Work. And I, at that time, was not working for the Sunday Times, and I never worked for Hasselblad, so I was eligible to enter. I entered two pictures. One picture, I absolutely thought, this is all about work. And what it was two guys splicing the insurance line of a ship, which is steel cable, splicing it. And I thought that was real work. And I thought, that's my picture. And then I asked myself the question, what picture would the Sunday Times like? Mm-hmm. And it was extraordinary. I'm so pleased I asked that question because the splicing picture never got anywhere. But the picture that actually worked, which is actually in this most recent volume, is of an old girl in a dilapidated office in Covent Garden turning her accounts pages. Mm-hmm. She's sitting at a desk, cross-legged, and I entered that picture, and in fact, it came second. So I won 1,000 quid's worth of Hasselblad. And when the picture, when the competition or the results of the competition were published in the Sunday Times, two publishers rang up the following day on the Monday and said, Clive, we'd quite like to see those pictures of yours again, you know. Oh, yeah. So Studio Vista published my first entirely black and white book on Covent Garden mm-hmm. in 1977. Amongst the members of the market, very successful. They loved it. They really felt, and they actually said that I've got it. Mm-hmm. You know, I'd really captured the essence of the market. In terms of the wider public, it was of no consequence. But it was totally black and white only. I had shot some colour at the time, of course, you know, but over the years, I'd forgotten how much colour. And some 36 years later, my partner and a friend of mine, who knew that there was colour in existence, said we should get those out. And my response was rather Anglo-Saxon, like, who the is going to be interested after all this time? Mm-hmm. I mean, we're talking about 36 years.
Yeah.
Who is going to be interested in old Covent Garden? It's gone. They're all dead. Well, most of them are. Anyway, I got them out, and a friend paid for the digitalisation of 100 transparencies. And publishers at Francis Lincoln immediately picked it up. They said, wow, we want that. And so in 2008, a hardback copy of the Covent Garden Market was published.
And why do you think there was that kind of nostalgic interest in Covent Garden? I mean, surely that has to do something with the fact that now it's kind of taking on a new life.
Totally new life. And I have to be honest with you, I simply would never have expected that to happen. Nobody was more surprised when that book took off. It took off from two points of view. Very interesting. One, the nostalgia, which you've just mentioned, and the nostalgia element to it. Second one was the children and grandchildren of the people that worked in the market suddenly began to spring up from everywhere, including a handful of the people that actually worked in the market and remembered me and said, my God, this is fantastic stuff. And it took on a completely new life. And I almost feel that the first publication in 1977 was just too close to it going. And it had to have that time.
A bit of distance. And now you've published this book, Covent Garden, Then and Now, and that's because you've been taking photographs of the place for decades.
Well, it was very interesting because my publisher, you know, I asked, you know, when's the publication date? And of course, as you know, most books are published in October for the Christmas market, you see. And they said, oh, we're publishing in August. And I said, well, why August? Well, because of the tourists. And I said, but tourists aren't going to be interested in something for, I mean, most of the tourists are under 40 anyway. They won't remember, and they're from another country. They won't remember Covent Garden, as it were. They won't be able to relate to it. And I was sitting down in Covent Garden having a spaghetti or something. And I suddenly thought, what I should do is shoot it now and marry the two lots of pictures. Then they've got something to relate to, hence this volume.
What is it today? You know, obviously there's been some changes in Covent Garden. What is it today that you find intriguing about the aesthetic of the neighbourhood?
I find it exciting because it is a natural development. And I think when you live a certain length of time, as I have, you see a place naturally change, organically change. It has to change. Covent Garden, Old Market, could not have gone on, even if they'd wanted it desperately to stay there. It wouldn't have worked. It was dying. It was going. society is changing. And I think Covent Garden now is, again, very exciting and changing. It is shocking to me that offices of Russell Chambers are now beautiful apartments at 5 million quid a throw. I mean, you know, there's no way that I could even afford, you know, I couldn't even afford a postage stamp there, let alone an apartment. But that said, it is the very centre of London. The pressure on the land is phenomenal, and the pressure on being able to produce something that works for everybody is also immense. And I think that, you know, given the kind of society we've got, it's beginning to work quite well.
That was David Michon speaking to photographer Clive Borsnell.
In a moment, we'll be trying to get through an interview about swearing without swearing. Wish us luck.
Each week on The Curator, one of our Monocle editors rounds up the very best of the week just gone on Monocle 24.
It's just always going to be different, for me at least. I've never recorded an album in the same place under the same circumstances as the last record, so it's always going to be quite different.
From hard-hitting political interviews to live music sessions, from food and film to retail and travel, we'll handpick the best of the week shows for an hour of essential listening.
The main market used to be Europe, of course, United States and Japan. Now you have tens of markets, very interesting, also regions. You have, of course, Russia, then you have Kazakhstan, you have so many other. It's a completely different world.
What could be greater than an hour of The Curator? Listen to it live or download it later.
That's The Curator, premiering every Saturday at 9 a.m. London time on Monocle 24. Brought to you in association with Rolex.
It's time to usher your children out the room and put the headphones on the cat, because there's no way to avoid the fact that over the next few minutes, there may be a deluge of bad language and filthy humour. Just another week at Monocle, you might think, but you'd be wrong.
We're actually about to speak to the author Melissa Moore, who's written a very pleasant and intelligently composed study on the history of bad language and its cultural significance throughout the ages, from the Romans onwards. We will try our absolute best to keep things civilised, but with no further ado, let's start things badly by introducing Melissa Moore, author of Holy Shit, A Brief History of Swearing, who joins us from New York. Melissa, welcome to the Monocle Weekly.
Oh, well, thank you very much for having me.
How did you even begin to think that writing a book about swearing was a good thing to do?
A good thing to do? Well, I think that they're, you know, very, very interesting words because they have just such different effects on people than other words do. You know, language can do a lot of things. It can persuade people. It can make people laugh. It can, you know, I suppose, you know, make people cry. But swear words can do a lot of those things, you know, just immediately. They, you know, when you swear at someone, it has a real visceral effect on someone, from increasing their heart rate, increasing your heart rate, just really being able to relieve pent-up emotions. And so that's kind of why I thought it would be interesting to write a book about swearing.
And Melissa, the title of the book is all important, because actually the holy and the shit, you kind of, in a way, you divide the book up into these two kind of categories of oaths and cusses and swear words. Could you just explain to us the significance of the title?
Yes, yeah, the title was, I mean, I like the title and I think it's catchy, but yeah, it's not just a gimmick. It is the holy and what I call the shit are the two main ways that people have sworn through the centuries, and a history of swearing is sort of a history of their alternation. So in ancient Rome, swearing was based on sexual taboos, like a lot of it is today, and so that was an era of, I guess you'd say, the shit. And then in the Middle Ages, switched over, and the most powerfully taboo words were really those, and so that was, you know, a period of the holy, and now we're kind of back to the shit, because sexual, excremental, and now racial obscenities are the ones that are the most powerful today.
When researching this book, did you find that there were words that were considered swear words in the past that are now fine, or indeed vice versa, bits of language which were, you know, not necessarily polite before, but have now become far worse than they were before?
Yeah, that was actually one of the really interesting things I found, the degree to which a lot of today's obscene words were not taboo in the Middle Ages, that it was, you know, such an era of the holy, and that word like by God's bones, a phrase like by God's bones had so much power that words, the, you know, the C word, shit, these words were actually not bad words in the Middle Ages. They didn't have the same power.
You tell lots of really interesting stories behind these swear words and in the book, and how they came about. And I think at the very beginning you set out that there's kind of thought to be the big six kind of swear words at the moment. In Roman times, they had the big ten. And I thought what was amazing was one of those was to kind of, you know, castigate somebody by telling them that they were a circumcised penis.
Yes, that was a very bad word. Yeah, you could call someone an erect or circumcised penis. And that had a lot to do with, well, different sexual taboos. So in ancient Rome, we today tend to divide people up into heterosexual, homosexual, and maybe bisexual. But in Rome, they divided people up into active and passive. And so it was all right for a man to be active as long as he could be the active partner with anyone sort of in any way, but he had to be the active one. And what was stigmatized was passivity. So there were a lot of bad words for people who kind of received sexual advances. And then the sort of other interesting thing about Roman obscenity was that some of it actually had religious functions. And I think that the erect circumcised penis as an insult kind of comes from both those directions. The obscene words were used in religious ceremonies, you know, for fertility purposes, and in wedding ceremonies, the bride would sit on a giant erect penis. I mean, a huge one, a statue, to ensure fertility. And so they're all. Roman obscenity has kind of it's in some ways very similar, but in some ways, you know, really interestingly different from ours.
Has this book changed the way that you perceive swear words? I mean, do you use different swear words than you did before? I'm assuming you don't, if in a fit of anger, call someone an erect, circumcised penis. But do you? Are you a bit more careful about the swear words that you use?
It is interesting. I am now much more aware of the effects that they have, because I just have seen it over and over, where you can be having a perfectly normal, or what I think is a perfectly normal discussion about swearing. You know, where we're not using the words, we're mentioning the words. You know, it's not that I'm calling someone anything. But people gradually get, you know, really offended. And these words just are so powerful. Even though the sexual obscenities are being used more and more, they still retain a great power.
Melissa, can I just ask you a couple of quick fire questions? After doing this book, is there a favorite swear word that kind of was dug up from history that you quite like the ring of?
I do like all the religious ones. I like the God's bones, Christ's precious blood, Christ's nails. Those were thought in the Middle Ages to be able to rip apart Christ's physical body as he sits in heaven, which I think is a very interesting, different idea. There are a lot of words that I discovered, Victorian words, that weren't swear words, but they weren't polite words, but they weren't, you know, you couldn't actually swear at someone by using them, but they were sort of obscene words that we don't have right anymore, like the huffle, which was a word for oral sex.
Just tell me, just quickly, do you think we swear more than we used to?
I think that we use more sexual and excremental terms than we used to, certainly than in the Victorian era, but that I think we use, you know, far fewer racial terms, which, you know, until about 1930 were not particularly taboo, and people would, you know, use them quite a lot, but since then, you know, that usage has been vastly curtailed.
And finally, just tell me, I know you've got children. So you were writing this book at home and you were reading out the manuscript. How did that go?
I think luckily I was working on it for long enough that my children kind of got bored. I've made it uncool.
Yeah, I just wanted to ask you actually on that point about, you know, swear words that mothers say in front of their children. When I was growing up, my parents tried very hard not to swear in front of me. In fact, a lot of good it did me. And my dad's solution was to say the words, but silently. Whereas my mum just replaced all the swear words with her own version. So fiddlesticks, or if she was particularly angry, blast. Was that something that you came across a lot of people trying to come up with swear word substitutes?
Yes, there are a lot of swear word substitutes, you know, right back even for the in the Middle Ages, by cockbones. There's a long history of that.
Well, Melissa, it's been bloody good speaking to you, and I hope you your book does incredibly well. It's really a great read, and as we were saying, it's not a joke book. It's an amazing read. It's academic. It's about etymology. It's about history, and it's about the way that we live. So I certainly recommend that you get hold of a copy. That was Melissa Moore, author of Holy Shit, A Brief History of Swearing.
Time now for a little bit more music. This is Charles Bradley with Strictly Reserved for You. That was Strictly Reserved for You by Charles Bradley. You're listening to The Monocle Weekly.
Well, that's almost the end of the show. A good show, Steve, and I enjoyed the bit about swearing. So my mum was a bit like your mum because she would say blast.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And if she got hit by a truck, she might have said bum. That was about as bad as it would get.
Yeah, blast was sort of, I think, the most serious one I ever got. I did quite like it when my dad swore without actually saying anything. He just very animated to go.
You see, I don't think I ever, you know, same, I don't think I ever heard my dad swear.
Really?
I don't think ever a single time. My mum had a few B words, but that was, you know, blast, bum.
I still remember the first time I heard my mum say shit. I was 16. It was a shocking event, which has stayed with me.
I think my mum would have switched over the TV channels when people swore. She was like that offended by it. But the funny ones were that all those other ones, as you said, those kind of filler ins like Gordon Bennett.
Yeah. Oh, Gordon Bennett's a good one.
Do people still say that?
I don't think they do.
Is that an aging thing?
I think it might
be. I mean, it's aging me. I say a ruder version of it, but ending things.
Yeah,
with,
I was a bit disappointed you didn't say that. So I wanted to know the etymology of that.
I oddly do say effing Henry quite a lot, which I've looked up, and I think it goes back to kind of religious things to do with Henry VIII. And I think it has kind of lingered in the English language for many a year. But my mum would also say, oh, bloody Henry. So that was, you know, Henry was often a name kind of, you know, castigated in our house.
I think my favourite part of the show was Downton Abbey. I think we should try and come up with other puns on particularly on Asian leaders, linking them into 19th century dramas.
I think that I can see a whole kind of host of them being cast in my TV series. I'm
honestly this time next week on the weekly we'll have a whole list for everything. Okay. Well, that's not for next week.
Good. Although I may not be here next week.
Oh no, of course you're not. Oh no, you know who's here next week with me?
Who's that?
Sophie Grove.
Well, good, because she's been on holiday this week and I've missed her. So,
okay.
Come back, Sophie Grove.
She'll be back with Asian puns and no swearing.
I can see her not swearing, but I can't see her having any Asian puns. I might have to email those in for you.
Okay.
Just to make sure we can stay getting in some kind of trouble. Anyway, today's show, it was produced by Tom Hall, and it was also researched by Josh, that bloody boy, Fennett, and Edward Lucas. And our studio manager was Jack Phillips.
I thought you were going to say Jack Phillips.
Anyway, there'll be two people in these chairs next week at the same time. One of them, as you've just heard, will be Steve, and one of them will be Sophie. So do join them again. But until then, it's goodbye from me, Andrew Tuck.
And from me, Steve Bloomfield.
Goodbye.